Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
So I want us to just think for a moment and discuss in pairs. I want you to imagine that you're back home in your country and you're sitting in your local coffee shop and you're talking to a non-Christian friend, colleague, or neighbor. And during the course of conversation, they say to you, you're a Christian. Tell me why. Well, actually, I'm not going to give you the question. This is what I want you to come up with. What is the question that you would most fear getting asked? Okay? So not, you know, what must I do to be saved? That would be wonderful, wouldn't it? But the kind of question or objection that people come up with in your culture to Christianity, that you're thinking, how do I answer this and maintain my friendship? How do I answer it and not get slapped? The kind of question that makes you pray for the immediate return of Christ, okay? Those kind of questions. Just discuss in pairs for 1 minute what that question might be. Okay, let's go round then, shall we? Let's start at the back this time. What question or questions did you come up with? Okay, about suffering, yep. And you have one as well? Okay, why God doesn't hear our prayers? Great. And sometimes I've heard people come and say, well, they've done experiments on prayers and, you know, there's no evidence that it makes any difference. Okay? Yeah? Sorry, hear prayer or answer. Okay? Great. Next group. Okay. So if they're just mocking Christianity. And it's helpful to know that sometimes there's a difference, isn't there, between what I call a question and a sneer. Think back to Genesis 3 when Satan says, did God really say? It wasn't a question, of course, was it? In many ways, it was a sneer. Did God really say? And sometimes people do that, don't they? You don't really believe that, ... to which I find the most helpful thing is just to be completely upfront and say, yeah, of course I do. What's the question? Because it's designed to make you feel, you know, who are you? Why do you believe that? The sneer, the mockery. Okay? Next. Great, that's very helpful to get that for a start. And it just shows some of the range of kind of questions and objections. And having traveled a bit across Europe, there are some, like the suffering one, that we say will be kind of crossing cultures. There'll be others that will be more particular to a certain culture. Now, what I'm not going to do now is give you an answer to all of those questions. For that, you'll need to go and buy my books. Well, you can if you want. But what I want to do today and tomorrow is to think in terms of having conversations, the kind of conversations you'll have in a coffee shop, how can we respond to these? And how can we use them as opportunities to actually present the gospel, okay? So that's what we're going to be thinking about, and we will come back to some of those as we go through. We'll see how far we get today. And what I want to do is give you 9 principles that I think will be helpful when it comes to answering these questions. And the first principle is that we need to be wise. I stole this actually from a bit tape from Beach Missions, the RH factor. Sorry if you're not English. We have an expression, something being a red herring in English means it's a distraction. And they said, you need to work out whether it's going to be a red herring or a real hindrance. That's what they meant by the RH factor. But think about it. Let's take the question of suffering for a start. Let's try and think of as many reasons why that question could come up. Start us off. Okay, so they're personally suffering. That could be it. And obviously you wouldn't necessarily know whether that was the case, depending on what that kind of suffering was. We don't always know, do we? Straight away, by appearances. Okay, what else? Okay, so someone close to them. And that's interesting because often it's harder, isn't it, watching suffering in others than it is going through it ourselves because we feel so powerless to do anything about it. So sometimes this question comes with the greatest emotion when it's someone close to them that's suffering. Yeah. Okay, so it's a way of kind of distracting attention from me to be able to kind of say, well, what about out there? Particularly maybe if someone's feeling convicted of sin, then to try and get out of it. Yes, but what about the suffering out there? So it's a kind of shifting the focus of the attention. So they just know that this is a difficult question. You know, let's maybe they, you know, want to just kind of make you feel, make, see you squirm. So let's ask the question about suffering. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so it's the question of justice that comes up. And the amount of times people ask that kind of Psalm 73 question, why do the good people suffer? Why do the bad people prosper? Comes up again. Yeah. Yeah, so it can be a genuine question, you know, why is this happening? Does this have some particular reason? Is God trying to punish? Yeah, the amount of people who think God is trying to punish them for something. Maybe they have a very sensitive conscience and they've put together something they've done with some suffering they're experiencing. They're saying, are these connected? So it's a moral objection, and that's very helpful to point out because there are two types of questions, really, aren't there? There's the intellectual questions, you know, does God exist? But there's the moral objections. So I don't know whether any of you saw, I think it was about a year ago now, 2 years ago, Stephen Fry, quite a famous TV presenter in the UK, was being interviewed on Irish television, and it kind of went viral on social media because he was asked, if you were to die and face God and discover, of course, that he existed, what would you say? And then for about 5 minutes, he just goes off on one about suffering and just naming thing after thing about suffering, just saying, you know, why this, why this, why this? And then he says at the end, my atheism is not just that I don't believe in God, but if there was a God, what kind of God is he? So absolutely, it's this moral objection that says, well, I don't have to believe in God because even if he was there, he's culpable for all of this. Yeah. Okay. Why else? Okay, so it could be academic, you know, they've just come from a philosophy class where, you know, this has been raised, the kind of philosophical question of if there is an all-powerful God, he would be able to stop suffering. If there's an all-loving God, he'd want to, and so on. So it might be that, okay? So suffering is a consequence of a particular choice that someone's made, and sometimes that does happen, doesn't it? There's a direct link on occasion. So it's not happening to them personally, but it is real suffering that's on TV. And then again, that could be all sorts of suffering, couldn't it? It could be terrorism. You know, why does God allow something like ISIS? It could be a natural disaster, an earthquake, tsunami, and so forth. So even that springs into different things depending on what they're thinking about. Okay, we could probably keep going, but can you just see for a start that that one question, suffering, has so many different reasons for coming up? And it's helpful to remember that because, and this is why we don't just give a kind of one-size-fits-all answer to each question, because depending on why the person has asked the question will very much depend on what you say in response to it. If they're asking the question philosophically, kind of from an academic basis, you could give a philosophical answer. You could say something like, to quote Tim Keller, you know, if God is big enough to be mad at for allowing suffering, he might also be big enough to have reasons for allowing it that you don't know about. Okay? A kind of philosophical answer to the philosophical objection. But if they're personally suffering, that's not going to help them at all, is it? That's really not going to connect. Similarly, they might be asking the question because they've just seen a natural disaster on the news. And if you answer it by talking about human freedom and the impact of sin upon the world through human freedom, unless you connect that back to original sin and so forth, that's not really going to answer the question, is it? If you just talk about sin being a consequence of people's choices. Okay? So the motivation behind the question is really key. It's really important to think, why is this question being asked? I don't know whether you've ever done this, but you've talked to one individual and you've answered their question and they've said, that's really, really helpful. And so you think, ah, good, I've got the answer now. And then you go and have another conversation and they ask you the same question and you give them exactly the same answer and they look at you like you're talking Chinese. Probably because they were asking the question for a different reason, okay? So be wise is the first thing, and we're going to come back to that. Here's the second point, and this is probably what we'll stick on for today because there's going to be a few sub-points on this. Be questioning. Answer questions with questions. Why do we do that? Firstly, because it helps us. How do you know whether the person that you've just met on the street, how do you know why they're asking this question about suffering? Well, you don't, do you? If they're a best friend, then you may do. But for the people that we're meeting for the first time, we have no idea about their background story. And so we're going to have to ask questions, aren't we, to know where this question is coming from. So if someone asks, why does God allow suffering? I might be tempted to ask, what kind of suffering are you thinking about? Is there a reason in particular why that is the big question for you? Okay? So get a bit of their background story, because it will help you know where to go when you answer the question. But also, and this is the important thing, asking questions not only helps us, but it also helps them. Okay, so here's a Bible trivia question. First question in the Bible. Did God really say? Satan, did God really say? And then the second question, after they eat the fruits, where are you? Now, have you ever thought, you know, why does Satan ask the question? Not because he doesn't know what God has said. Why does God ask the question? Certainly not because God doesn't know where they are. It's not as if he's playing hide and seek. You know, where is Adam? Is he behind the oak tree? That's not the case. So they're not asking questions because they don't know the answer. They're asking questions because both Satan and God know the power of questions, both negatively in the case of Satan to cast doubts, but positively in the case of God to reveal truth and to bring conviction and so forth. And so when you get to the Gospels, Jesus, over 200 times in the Gospels, asks questions when people come asking him questions. Very often he responds with questions. Never, of course, because Jesus doesn't know about people's stories. We know that Jesus knew what was going on in people's hearts. They didn't need to say it. So he's not asking a question for his benefit. He's always asking for their benefit. And it was very much the rabbinical tradition, teaching through questions. My dad was a teacher, and it used to really frustrate me because I would go to him wanting the answer, and he would only ever ask me questions. But he knew that if he asked questions, I would work out the answer in a way that would stick, whereas if he gave me the answer, I probably wouldn't always remember. So asking questions can help other people. How? Let's have a look at some of the ways that this can work. Firstly, it can help people think through their assumptions. Everybody has assumptions about Christianity, and many of them are wrong, aren't they? So think for a minute about the story of the rich young ruler, okay? The guy who comes running up to Jesus and says, "Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" Now think, what is the assumption that lies behind that question? That you can do something to get eternal life. Eternal life is something you earn through what you do, right? Which is pretty much the assumption that most people have when they come to religion, isn't it? If you're going to get into heaven, right with God, or whatever, at the end of life, it's something you do that gets you there. And that's his assumption. So what does Jesus do? He doesn't answer the question, does he? He says, "Why do you call me good?" And then he says, "No one is good except God alone." You see, this guy thinks, if I can be good enough, then I can get to heaven. And Jesus is saying the only person who's good enough to get to heaven is God. And your application to join the Godhead has just been revoked. You're not good enough. So he's getting him to question that assumption about goodness. Am I good enough? Actually, no, we're not. Okay. And then opening it up into the discussion as it went along. And lots of people come with assumptions that lie behind their objections. Think about it. If you say to someone, "I am a Christian, and I am going to heaven, and because you're not a Christian, you are not." Why do they get so offended? Exactly. Why? Because of this assumption, right? The assumption is good people go to heaven, bad people don't. So if you say, "I'm a Christian, I'm going to heaven, and I don't think people who are not Christians are not going to heaven," then of course they're going to get offended, because what they hear is, "I am better than you. I'm morally superior." So think about, what is the assumption that lies behind the objection? Why is this an issue? How can we tackle that? So you may want to ask the question, who do you think should go to heaven? And that would open up the assumption, wouldn't it? So that's the first thing. It helps people think through their assumptions. On a very practical level, it ensures that we have conversations. Does anyone know somebody who, when you ask them a question, responds by talking at you for about half an hour? Okay, anyone know anyone like that? Okay, if they're in the room, put your hand down. We know what it's like, don't we? You know, there is a certain type of person who is so prone to talk at you that you try and talk to them in statements rather than questions. So you don't say, "How are you?" You just say, "You're looking well." Because you know that if you ask them a question, they will just talk without limits. Now, Knowing what you do about that person, does it make you want to ask them more questions or less? Less, okay? Always less. Because no one likes it when we're being talked at rather than talked to. Now, herein is the problem, because all of the questions that we just looked at are huge issues. There are books and books written on each of these questions. And there is therefore so much that we could say when someone raises this question in conversation. But if you say it all, you've just killed the conversation. And they're probably going away thinking, gosh, I now know a bit more, but I don't want to ask any more questions because I'll get another mini sermon. As I think Ellis Potter put it so helpfully at Le Brie, he said, questions are the beginning of a conversation and statements and answers are the end of a conversation. So don't begin with the end. Always begin with questions. Explore the issue. And hopefully by asking questions, what you'll do is make sure that both of you do the same amount of talking. I always think it's a good test when you've had a conversation about Christian things to look back at the conversation in your mind and say, who did the most talking? If you were doing all the talking, there was something wrong. You probably want to aim for an even amount of talking in that conversation. And the way to do that is to ask questions. Now, not all questions are equally helpful, and this is why you have to work at them. But they will help make sure that you aren't doing all the talking. And then asking questions will define the issue. Asking questions defines the issue. People use words in conversations. And what they mean by the word is not necessarily what we mean by the word. And this is really important. A few months ago now, I was getting my hair cut. The lady cutting my hair, she's a new lady working at the hairdressers that day. And she didn't know who I was, so she was asking questions. I explained what my job was. And that normally either opens up a conversation or closes it down very quickly. On this occasion, it kind of opened it up. And she said, oh, that's very interesting. I really admire your faith. And so I said to her, that's good. What do you think faith is? And she thought for a moment and she said, faith is the ability to believe things that aren't true. And she wasn't being sarcastic, she was being deadly serious. And so I looked at her in the mirror and I said, do you admire my ability to believe things that aren't true then? And she paused for a moment and started to think through what she had just said. And then I continued, I think I would pity people that have that ability. Wouldn't you? Now, if I had responded to her compliments or seeming compliments, I admire your faith, by saying, thank you very much, you should have faith too, I would actually be telling her, you should also believe things that aren't true, which is, of course, not what I'm saying. So to ask the question, what do you mean by that word, is very helpful, isn't it? Don't assume that what people say or what the words people use carry the same meaning for them. Always discuss, what do you mean by that? What do you think that means? You know, people use the word God, but why should we assume it's the loving Trinitarian God of the Bible they're thinking about? Or not the God of their invention or a God of another religion? People use the word hell, but why should we assume that what they've got in mind is a biblical definition of judgment and not what they've seen on The Simpsons or what they've just seen in some artwork? So again, explore what people mean when they use words in questions. And then asking questions will particularly help when people are antagonistic. When people are there, as we said, just, you know, particularly they may be asking the question about suffering just to trick you, just to catch you out. At this point, I think a question is helpful, and our model in this is the person of Christ, isn't it? So when people were asking Jesus questions because they wanted to know the answer, Jesus often just gave them the answer. But when they asked him questions trying to trick him, Jesus' response was often to answer with a question, wasn't it? So think about the, you know, should we pay taxes to Caesar or not? Very good trick question, because if Jesus says yes, he's siding with the Romans, the Jews will hate him. If he says no, he's going against the authority of Rome, and the Romans will want to kill him. So whatever he says, he's going to offend half his audience. Okay? Very good trick question. So what does Jesus say? Another question. Show me a coin. Whose image is on it? Caesar's. Okay, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God what is God's. Now, interestingly, they never follow up with the question they should have asked, which was, okay, what is God's? You know, if the coin belongs to Caesar because it's got Caesar's images on it, what belongs to God? I think Jesus would have responded by saying, whose image is on you? You know, the coin belongs to Caesar, it's got Caesar's images on it. You are created in the image of God. You belong to God. God's more interested in you than your money. But they weren't interested in knowing the answer to the question. They just wanted to trick Jesus. So they didn't bother asking the follow-up question. Or just after that, remember when they come to Jesus saying, by what authority are you doing these things? Now they've buttered him up with lots of compliments, but Jesus knows, he sees through their duplicity and says, yeah, and he knows that they're trying to trick him. And so you remember what he says? He says, John's baptism, was it from heaven or was it from men? And they go away and they have a little bit of a confab and they say, well, if we say it was from heaven, then they'll say, why didn't you believe him? And if we say it was from men, they'll stone us to death because they think John was a prophet. So they come back to Jesus and they say, we don't know. And Jesus said, neither will I tell you. Have you ever noticed that that's not grammatically correct? If someone says to you, I don't know, then you say, I don't know either. But if someone's really saying to you, I'm not going to tell you, then of course it's perfectly fine to say, neither will I tell you. So what Jesus is doing in his response is genius, isn't it? Because he's really saying, I know that you're not stupid enough to answer my question, and I'm not stupid enough to answer yours. It's a brilliant way to respond to a trick question. Jesus says, be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. Notice the motive of the question, respond accordingly. Sometimes the right thing to do is not to answer the question when the question is there, simply to catch us out. I'll give you a couple of examples. Both of them actually come from Liverpool University, where I was speaking at a mission week a few years ago. For some particular reason, the questioning at this mission week was more hostile than any other mission week we'd done. Michael was there. And I was doing a talk on the issue of sexuality. At the end of the talk, some people came in that hadn't heard any of the talk, okay? And they'd been sent from the LGBT, the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender Society. And I guess they'd basically been sent to get me to give a soundbite answer to a question that they could then report in the paper to probably try and close down the student group. So they said, what do you think of gay people? What do you think of homosexuality? I thought, my first instinct was, gosh, I need to pray. So I prayed an arrow prayer to the Lord. And then I said, the problem with that question is that in our culture, people have defined Christianity by what it says about homosexuality. I said, but actually Christianity primarily is about Jesus Christ. Now, Jesus Christ has lots to say about all sorts of things, including sex and marriage. I said, but you'll never understand it unless you know who he is. I said, look, at the end of the day, if Jesus Christ rose from the dead, what he says about sex is important. If he didn't rise from the dead, what he says about everything is unimportant because he's a complete fraud. But the most fundamental question is, did Jesus Christ rise from the dead or not? Let's start with that question, and then we can move to the other one, shall we? Now, I was deliberately avoiding the question because I knew that they didn't really want to know the answer. On another situation, in Leicester University, a student came up and said, what does the Bible say about homosexuality? And I really sensed that he was asking it for a genuine reason. We talked at length after the event for about half an hour. He came back the next night, and he became a Christian. And he said, I just wanted to know that there was an answer to that question. Okay? Two very different motives and two very different responses. Okay? Another guy came to me at Liverpool University the next day, and he said, well, what about all that violence in the Old Testament? Why does God authorize war? So I said to him, what would you do about ISIS? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, what would you do? What do you think we should do, you know, with this problem? And he said, well, I don't know. I said, do you think we should all go to Iraq and Syria and tell ISIS to stop being so nasty to each other and start loving everyone? He said, well, that's not going to do any good, is it? I said, no. So if in the 21st century we're not quite sure how to deal with the problem of evil in certain parts of the world, maybe it was more complex 3,000 years ago than you make out. Okay? Maybe there's more to this question than meets the eye. Now, he didn't really want to know the answer, so we didn't really go there. But what I was trying to do was just highlight the problem. I could have tried to answer the question. There is an answer to the question, but he wouldn't have actually listened to any of it because of his attitudes. So when people are being antagonistic, think, how can I respond with a question? Five more minutes, and then we'll pause. And two more things on this. But also, asking questions helps when people are apathetic. Sometimes people's issue is not that they are antagonistic, but they're the opposites. And in some ways, that's harder, isn't it? If someone wants to object, at least you can have a conversation, even if it's slightly heated. But when someone just says, "I don't care." I was doing a mission week in Denmark a couple of years ago in Copenhagen, and I found, probably in my travels across Europe, that the kind of apathy that you get in Denmark is probably the greatest, not from Christians, but from non-Christians in that country. A number of reasons for it, I think. But basically, it means that when you give an evangelistic talk like I had just done on the resurrection of Christ, really going for it in terms of trying to, you know, put across the implications of the importance of this, the response I got was probably not unnatural, which was that I spoke to these two girls and I said, "What do you think of that?" And this girl looked at me and she says, "I'm not really interested in all this. I'm not bothered." Which is a bit discouraging when you've just spent half an hour trying to urge people of the importance of it. So what did I say? Well, I said to her, "What are you bothered about?" See, what I discovered is that not everybody immediately or initially is bothered about Christianity, but everybody is bothered about something, aren't they? I've not yet met anybody who isn't bothered about anything. People care about something. So she said, "Well, I care about love. That's what I think is important." So I said to her, "That's great. What do you think love is?" And she looked at me and she said, "I don't know." So I said, "Look, I'm not trying to trick you. I just thought, as you care about this, you might know what it is." She said, "Well, I don't know." So I said, "Can I give you a definition of love?" And she said, "Sure." So I didn't give her a biblical definition. She wouldn't have been ready. So I said, "I take it you don't believe in God." She said, "No." I said, "Okay, love is a chemical reaction that has evolved over time in our brains to make us attracted to people of the opposite sex so that we reproduce and pass on our DNA." And she looked at me and she said, "That is not love." Probably because her boyfriend was sitting next to her. And I said to her, "Why?" And she said, "I don't know." And I said, "If we're nothing more than evolved species that have evolved over time with chance, then how can we say that love is anything more?" And then she said to me, "Okay, what do you think love is?" And then we had a very interesting conversation about the origins of love, about God, you know, the Trinity, and all sorts of stuff. And she was interested because now she could see how God and the Christian worldview had something to say about what mattered to her. Francis Schaeffer talked about this in terms of taking the roof off someone's position. He said people live in their house, it's all very comfortable, but they've never been exposed to the elements because no one's pushed them to the conclusions of their worldview. So ask people questions. What do you care about? And then how does your worldview account for it? Why is that so important? And what you find again and again is that the secular atheistic worldview that is predominant in Europe has nothing to say about what's really important in Western Europe, in my experience, particularly. I'll give you one more example. I was sitting on a train traveling from Romania all the way across to Budapest, where I was flying home from a couple of years ago. And we had about, I think it was about 20 hours to talk because it got so delayed. And I was chatting next to this guy next to me who was a student. So I said, "Well, what do you do?" He said, "Well, I'm studying environmental sciences at university in Budapest. I'm from Romania." And he said, "What do you do?" I said, "Well, I work," and explain my job. And it was one of those times where you could see by his facial expression that the conversation had just closed down. He was not interested at all in Christianity. So I thought, "Well, I'm not going to go there. Let's talk about what he does." So I said to him, "Why did you study what you study?" Which I often find is a very good question to start with, because people have often got some motive for what they're interested in. He said, "Well, I really care about the environment. I think it's really important. I think it's a travesty that we're ruining the environment." And then I said to him, "Why do you think we should care for the environment?" And he said, "Well, because we should." I said, "But not everybody thinks we should. So why do you think you're right and they're wrong?" He said, "Because we should." I said, "Yes, but there are some people who say we shouldn't. What makes you think that you're right and they're wrong?" He says, "Because I am." He said, I said, "That's not very good in the discussion, though, is it?" He says, "Don't you think we should care for the environment?" I said, "Absolutely." He said, well, why do you think we should care for the environment? And again, we then had a very interesting conversation about a biblical worldview. And again, he didn't think he was going to be interested in Christianity. He was apathetic. He cared about the environment. But when he saw that the environment connected to a Christian worldview, he was then interested. So when people are apathetic, ask questions about what they are interested in, and then use that as an avenue. So ultimately, the gospel. You may not get there all in one go, but that would be the aim. And then lastly, for now, asking questions can get to the heart. There are two ways I think this can help. Sometimes, when you're in a conversation and you're going round in circles, you feel that no matter how many questions you answer, there'll be more to come. Okay? You've all been in that kind of situation. I find a helpful question to ask is simply to say, listen, I'm very happy to answer your questions, but if I could answer them all satisfactorily, would you become a Christian? Would you follow Jesus? And generally the answer is no. And then I would simply say, okay, what is it that's really stopping you from seriously following Jesus Christ? And then normally what comes out is a completely different issue to the ones that have been presented so far. I don't want to stop sleeping with my girlfriends. I went to church as a child and you know, the person who I got to know there abused me in some way or so on. You get to the heart issue, and that's really important that we get to the underlying issues. You won't get there straight away. Sometimes the presenting issues are an avenue to get to the heart. Or the other question, which can simply be, what's stopping you from putting your trust in Jesus? Sometimes people are quite happy to ask questions all day long, but it doesn't mean that they're not ready to make that step of commitment to Christ. And of course, as Christians, we're always asking questions, aren't we? It's not that we've stopped asking questions or researching these things. But the question, what's stopping you, can also get to the heart. So there's a few ways in which questions can help us. And I make no apology for spending a bit of time on that today. There are some other principles we'll look at tomorrow. Because I think our danger often is we jump too quickly into responding to the question without exploring these questions first. Remember what we said? A statement is the end of a conversation, a question is the beginning. So don't start at the end, start at the beginning as we explore with questions.